Good afternoon. The Health and Human Services Finance Division will come to order. We do have a quorum. We have the minutes before us of February 27th. Is there a motion to approve the minutes?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Hamilton moves to approve the minutes of February 27th. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. The minutes are approved. Okay, members, we have a very full agenda today. Thank you to the audience for quieting down. I know there's a lot of interest in the bill that we're going to be hearing next, and so I appreciate your cooperation on that. So we are going to hear first House File 400. So if we could have Representative Olson and Representative Baker, is he here yet?
Yeah.
Okay, well, when Representative Baker arrives, we'll have him come to the table as well. Welcome to the committee, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
So Representative Olson moves that House File 400 be recommended to the Committee on Ways and Means.
Yes, Madam Chair.
So Representative Olson, please go ahead and present your bill and go ahead and call your testifiers.
Great. Thank you, Madam Chair. And I do have an author's amendment that I'll also need to make an oral amendment on.
All right. So do you want to take that first?
Yes, Representative Olson? That would be helpful.
And is that the A20 amendment, Representative Olson?
Yep, the A20. And then I have an oral amendment I need to make as well.
All right. What is the oral amendment?
So the oral amendment is a technical amendment on page 4, delete line 16.
Page 4, delete line 16, did you say?
Correct.
Okay. So we're going to delete line 16, page 4, line 4.16. I'm going to delete that line, and we're going to incorporate, I'll make the motion you're on the committee.
I'm on
so Representative Olson, sorry.
Sorry,
Representative Olson is going to incorporate that change into her amendment, and she will move then the A20 amendment to get the bill in the shape in which she'd like to discuss it. So all those in favor of that amendment, please say aye.
Aye.
All opposed,
aye.
No. The motion prevails. The amendment with that incorporated change is adopted. Is that in the shape now in which you'd like to discuss the bill?
Yes, Madam Chair.
All
thank
right.
you.
Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee, and thanks you to for allowing myself and Representative Baker to present House File 400. As we all know, we are in the middle of an opioid crisis. Parents have lost children. Teachers have lost students. Our first responders are asked to respond to impossible situations, and no other family deserves to go through this, and Minnesotans expect us to take action and act in comprehensive treatment, prevention, and recovery strategies. Opioid overdose deaths have skyrocketed in recent years, increasing 66% between 2010 and 2016. And just this year, the CDC announced a drop in life expectancy in the U.S., due in part to the continuing rise in the drug overdose deaths. 422 Minnesotans have lost their lives to opioid overdose deaths in 2017. 4 out of every 5 new heroin users started with an opioid prescription. According to MDH, in Minnesota, more than 3.1 million opioid prescriptions were reported as dispensed in 2017. Meanwhile, drug companies AmerisourceBergen, McKesson, and Cardinal Health all had fourth quarter revenues ranging from $35 billion to $51.6 billion. As the author of this legislation, I walk the halls of the Capitol, and I am often pulled aside by someone with tears in their eyes who tells me the story of someone they love who is impacted by this issue. These are lobbyists that work on other issues, staff, fellow legislators, and visitors from all your districts. They whisper an encouraging word to keep working. Through blurry eyes, I have been gifted with knowing the stories of so many Minnesotans. Even as I sat at the head table with business leaders at our local chamber breakfast last week, a bank president leaned over to me, her voice cracked, And she said, "I hope you know how close to home your work hits for me." Or the news reporter who, after the camera stopped rolling, broke into tears, saying he lost a fiance and their unborn child to opioids. It's an honor to be here today to present this legislation. I carry with me all of these stories. And the bravery of all of the parents who have sat at this testifier's table for the last 3 years. Your courage is astounding. While families, communities, and the state as a whole have paid a significant price during the opioid crisis, both in dollars and in tragic life loss, House File 400 brings more of the actors in the crisis to invest in efforts around prevention, education, treatment, and recovery initiatives. House File 400 builds off the great bipartisan bicameral work done last session, but sadly did not move forward. Many of these provisions are not new to this bill, but build from what was brought forward last session. House File 400 requires a license and registration of opioid manufacturers and wholesale distributors of opioids. The bill requires the Board of Pharmacy to assess manufacturers' registration fees in the total amount of $12 million on a prorated basis based on the total number of opioid units sold. The bill requires the Board of Pharmacy to assess a wholesaler registration fee in the total of $8 million, prorated based on the wholesaler's percentage of the total number of opioid units. And just for a little context on these current fees, the current fee for a manufacturer is $240. And to put this in further context to the cost this crisis has had, my county, St. Louis County, has spent $26 million in out-of-home placement costs directly related to opioid addiction. And there's a handout in your packet that will also show the out-of-home child care or child placements in your own county. This bill does cover generic opioids, as we know that these drugs make up the majority of opioid units sold, according to the FDA. These revenues, in addition to any funds received by the state from the settlement of legal proceedings against the opioid manufacturers, are deposited in a stewardship account. This bill forms an advisory council of a variety of stakeholders who will make recommendations on a grant and funding options for funds annually appropriated to the DHS commissioner from the stewardship account. The bill further provides detailed appropriations aimed at education, prevention, and treatment, and providing money to county social services to fight this crisis, as well as specific appropriations for tribes and American Indian organizations who have been deeply impacted by this crisis. This bill places prescriber guidelines on quantities, certain limitations on dispensing, and provider education. And it seeks to increase access to non-pharmacological pain management options and also deals with situations where medication costs less than a copay. The bill also has language for a non-opioid directive and requires disposal receptacles at sheriff's office. In short, this bill acknowledges the significant costs that are needed to fight this crisis, while knowing not everything can be addressed in one bill. What this bill does is take a step forward in bringing solutions to a crisis that needs serious investment. And with that, I'll turn it over to Representative Baker.
Thank you, Representative Olson. Welcome to the committee, Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and fellow members of the committee. I'll be brief. Many of us have heard this bill before. This has made many stops along the way this year. This has been the hardest bill that I've had to work on, just because we have to get this one right, because there's not a lot of precedent around the country on this bill when we are asking other folks to help us in this matter that is in a complete crisis mode. Most of you know my son passed away 7 years ago, and he would have been 32 years old a couple weeks ago. I don't talk about it at each one of these meetings and our hearings, but this is my team here, and this is my committee. And so I've been looking forward to this one for a long time. And, you know, Dan Baker was a great guy. He did not intend to be an addict. And when he got hurt as an injury, we knew the risks that he was facing. His doctor was actually pretty good about saying, "Now, Dan, be careful. This could be really addictive." And his mom, Mary, was there with. And so... the whole time, his mom was with him the whole time through all those appointments. And as carefully as I think that the doc was trying to provide that insight, there are certain things in certain brains that click harder than others, that I've learned so much about addiction. So this isn't just about opioids. This is about addiction and what it does to the brain, and especially a young brain, the one that is not fully developed. And so my mission, as I later became a legislator who has a passion and a personal story, has a little more meaning to me. So as this thing gets closer to what I hope is the finish line, it's becoming a lot more breathtaking for me to think that we're actually going to maybe get there this year. I really believe in my heart there was not an initial intention from folks that had been selling oxycodones and hydrocodones and opioids for many, many years. I mean, hundreds of years it's been around to use in medicine. And I've always wanted to be clear, I don't want to see this take away any access for people that need these pills. These are an important part of medicine. But what happened early on, in the mid-90s now, with a company that really said they had the answer for this pain that's going to be less addictive, and they really provided some bad information, I don't think they still intended to hurt anybody. They just wanted to make money. The problem that I have and the personal anger that I have is when they saw clearly indications things were going wrong, they did not do the right thing and pull it off the shelf and remarket or relook at what they were doing. I give credit back in the day when there was a Tylenol scare back in the early 80s when Johnson & Johnson didn't know why people were dying when people were taking an aspirin over the counter. Well, bad people were taking medicine and making it into poison, which is a different story. But that company did the right thing, and they pulled everything off the shelf because they didn't know. And that was a moment in my life when I was a grocer then, and I was just shocked at these shelves were empty for months on end because they had to do it right to reintroduce this very popular brand. And then to look at what's happened now is just it's embarrassing, it's shameful, and how they did not react when they had the information that I now know they had. So with that, members, I stand side by side with Representative Olson to carry this bill to the finish line. We're going to make this a good bill. We're making it better every time it makes a stop. And we have a lot of folks that do want to share their thoughts perhaps today, too. But with that, Madam Chair, I will hold any further comments at this point. But thank you for the time today.
All right. Thank you, Representative Baker. And we are the team here. We are your team. Thank you for saying that. Representative Olson, do you want to call a testifier?
Yes, Madam Chair.
Welcome to the committee. If you would just introduce yourself for the record and please go ahead.
Madam Chair, I'm Lieutenant Jeff Jasel. I'm a lieutenant with the Duluth Police Department and the commander of the Lake Superior Drug and Violent Crime Task Force. My task force is one of 21 violent crime and drug enforcement teams in the state. We have a region that we cover that includes St. Louis County, Carlton County, Lake County, and Superior, Wisconsin. First, let me thank the committee for giving me this opportunity to speak again on this very trying issue of opioids. I'd like to start out with a story. It's a true story, and it clearly reflects the problems that we're seeing in our community with this epidemic. Last year, I was in my office, and one of my investigators came to my door, knocked on the door, and asked if he could speak with me, and he looked clearly upset. I said, sure, come in. What's going on? And he sat down, closed the door behind him, and he said, Jeff, I had a dinner party last night, or over the weekend. I invited some of my friends over, people that we've known for 20 years, came to the party. We had a nice time. Party went well. People went home safe. But the next day, the next Monday morning, he had somebody at his front door, and he answered the door, and it was one of his friends sitting there crying. She was crying, and she handed him a bottle of pills. My investigator had neck surgery the month prior to the dinner party and was prescribed opioid pain pills that he kept in his medicine cabinet. That's the reality that we're in. A good friend of 20 years went into a drug cop's medicine cabinet and stole his pills because of addiction. That's the reality. I sit here today with two emotions. The emotion of disappointment and hope. Disappointment because I was here almost 1 year ago today testifying for a similar stewardship bill, looking for support, looking for resources to go after this problem. That bill had lots of support on both sides of the aisle, but in the end, it never received a final vote. But I have hope. Disappointment because I have to come to this committee today and tell you that St. Louis County just had the worst month they've ever had with opioid deaths in January of this year. We had 5 opioid deaths, 4 of them in Duluth alone. But I have hope. Disappointment for the fact that I represent a county that has had the worst, or one of the worst, overdose death rates in the state for the past 6 years. But I have hope. I have hope because last year we received a generous donation from the Rumler Foundation that provided Narcan for our law enforcement in our rural communities of our task force area. It was greatly needed. I have sheriffs, I have chiefs that all understand the need for this life-saving drug. I have hope because since we started the program in 2016, we've saved over 72 lives. Narcan works. I have hope because last year we were awarded a federal grant that provided for more Narcan for our task force region. But more importantly, it provided for overdose follow-up. I am very proud and happy to report that our newly appointed opioid program technician has brought 6 people to Rule 25 assessments and has gotten them into treatment. That's 6 people that are no longer in that pool of addiction that drives the demand that causes all the problems that we have. These are the types of programs that we need. As a law enforcement agency, we go after the source of supply. But we knew that alone was not going to solve this problem. So we started thinking outside of the box. And programs like this are going after that other side of the equation, going after the demand and getting people help that they need. I'm guessing everybody's asking what this can is here. It's not my water glass. It represents the problem of opioids that Minnesota's had. This is the same problem that was brought to this legislature last year, but the problem got kicked down the road. I'm asking you today to support this stewardship bill for resources to get people help, to help to solve the problem. And most of all, I'm asking you, let's not kick this can down the road again. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Kazel. Appreciate your testimony. And members, I just want to let you know that we inadvertently distributed the wrong version of House File 400. So we are getting the correct version. If any of you are looking at the language and something isn't right for you, we will have that distributed shortly. I'm going to just go ahead and let the let Representative and Representative Baker's testifiers complete their testimony before we take questions, and then we'll pause there if that's okay. I assume that everyone will stay here after they testify to be available for questions. So Why don't we call the next testifier then? Dr. Reznikoff, I think. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, my name is Charlie Reznikoff. I'm a doctor at Hennepin County Medical Center and in Rice County. Thank you for having me here today. I'm an addiction medicine doctor, and I'm a general medicine doctor in Hennepin County and Rice County. I work with patients in pain, but I also work with patients who are addicted to opioids, and I work with patients who are both in pain and addicted to opioids. I'll start by telling you about a man named James. James was an Eagle Scout in high school. He lives in Faribault. He joined the Peace Corps, and he went to Africa with his childhood sweetheart, wife-to-be. Unfortunately, he got a rare, painful condition, and he was appropriately started on opioids for that condition. But he had a bad reaction to the opioids. He got addicted. It nearly ruined his life, ruined his family. He did recover. The important thing to know is that James was a middle-aged guy with no criminal records, did no drugs, didn't even drink when this happened. I also want you to know about a man named Cedric. Cedric's from Minneapolis. He has sickle cell disease. He was also appropriately started on opioids for his disease. He, unlike James, he actually had a good reaction to the opioids. It restored his quality of life. He did well on them. They seemed to be safe. His problem was that because people are so scared of opioids and because people don't understand sickle disease, every time he needed medication, people treated him like a criminal. James and Cedric are both good people. Right? Neither is more strong nor more moral or more of an upstanding citizen. But James and Cedric are both struggling today because of opioids for a different reason. So I think both of them deserve policy that protects them. They both deserve policy that protects them. So here's my take. Opioids help many people, but they also hurt some people badly. We do not have a way to predict who they will help and who they will hurt. Any time we are prescribing opioids, some people are going to be hurt by it. It's inherent to the drug. We can't split it out. There's no world where we prescribe opioids and it only helps everyone and nobody gets hurt. So it's within the medication. So at the same time, we can't just cut everyone off. If we cut everyone off, it would first of all be inhumane, and second of all, it'd be bad medicine. And there's nothing in this bill that would prevent people who needed opioids from getting opioids. So we're not just going to cut everyone off either. So how do you move forward? The only way to continue treating opioids for pain is to build up the system to support those that are harmed by opioids. In other words, for us to prescribe opioids when warranted, we need a really robust system to treat addictions when they happen. And that's really what this bill is intended to do, I believe, is to build up our system to support those that are hurt by opioids, allowing us to use opioids when warranted more safely. Okay, so the medical community is coming to understand this. I believe they're doing their best to step up. It's slow, but it's happening. We docs have been subject to fees and regulations and guidelines, and I've been part of some of that. I can tell you about it if you want. This bill has mandated education. The patients are also expected to go through a whole new set of safety rules, which is an inconvenience to them, but is meant to protect them. I think the group that has been hurt the worst by opioids is the Minnesota taxpayer. A huge amount of money has fallen, a huge amount of burden has fallen on them, both in cost of cleaning up the opioid epidemic and in lost productivity. There's a lot of lost productivity, healthcare workers and workers in general. I would say that the one group, there is a few entities that have profited but not contributed to the solution. And those, and you can guess, are the pharmaceutical industry and distributors. So here's my take. I'm not anti-pharma. I think we need industry to participate with us to deal with medical issues in a variety of ways. But as I said, opioids have an inherent risk to them. I worry when an industry profits from the upside but externalizes the downside to the taxpayer. So I believe that the downside, the risks, the harms of opioids have been externalized to the taxpayer, and we're cleaning up the mess. And I think it's important that everybody be at the table to help clean up the mess together, especially people profiting from it. So finally, this bill does nothing to limit access to opioids for people in chronic pain. This bill holds docs accountable for education, and it finds a mechanism for industries who have profited and done the least to solve the opioid epidemic to contribute somewhat to the solution. And by the way, the amount of money this bill generates is actually pretty minor compared to the amount of financial harm done to the state. So it's the beginning of a process of building the infrastructure to protect those who get addiction, and that will then indirectly allow us to more comfortably provide opioids when warranted. So, in short, I support this bill. Thank you very much for your time, and I'll take questions then.
All right, Dr. Reznikoff, thank you very much. Ms. Elkington, welcome to the committee.
Hi. Thank you. My name is Shelley Elkington. I thank you for your time and attention today as I sit here and testify in support of House File 400. Representative Olson and Baker are true heroes, and I need you all to know that. I know what they go through trying to bring this bill forward and what they have to kind of go through to make sure it works right. And as a parent who has lost a child, it's not lost on me the work they're doing and what they've given up for this. So I do want to say that. Thank you. So thank you also as a committee for indulging me once again to sit before you. I've testified before some of you before. It never gets easier for me. This isn't a fiction story I tell. This is my reality. I'm cognizant of the purpose of the committee. I know your purpose is on finance and cost benefits, so I'll try and relate some testimony to that. My daughter, Casey Jo, died as a result of her addiction to opioids on August 19th, 2015. She was 26 years old. She was prescribed many opioids over the course of 18 months to 2 years while being hospitalized after several complications for surgeries for a condition called Crohn's disease. She had an appointment to enroll in a Suboxone clinic here in Minneapolis on August 20th, 2015. Yes, that's one day. We were one day too late. Casey's death is still being investigated as a homicide, and we are left wondering what her last moments were like. Casey Jo was on Social Security disability at 24 years old. She went from being a champion swimmer, a dancer, a college student, to trying to stay out of withdrawal symptoms every day. She would go to emergency room, get admitted to hospitals. She bought drugs off the street. She diverted other meds. She misused her prescriptions that she had. She could not keep a job. She could not even keep basic appointments. She was rendered helpless because of her addiction. It's been estimated that there are over 100 people in my community who are heroin users. I live in a town of less than 5,000 people in West Central Minnesota. We have several doctors in our clinic who now participate in the ECHO program who are prescribing Suboxone and helping those who are struggling with opioid addiction get into treatment, get their lives back, and allow them to be productive working members of our community like my daughter wanted to be. As a home health care provider, I see opioid addiction firsthand. 95% of my clients are in state-funded medical services. I see people that want to be better. I see people who are looking for solutions, solutions that are not sustainable right now, but real solutions like the ones that are offered in this bill. They want to take care of their families. They want to feel empowered and engaged, but they are unable to. You are all in amazing positions here. You have the chance to be on the side of right. There aren't many opportunities in life where that presents itself, and I'm sure it's uncomfortable. These pharmaceutical companies right here in this room are threatening to raise prices so people who need these meds cannot afford them. They tell you this as a mean of extortion. That's all it is. In the meantime, people are dying, children and families are hurting, and as much as their threat should be taken seriously, it amazes me that you allow it to happen. I watched 60 Minutes the other night through tears, listening to a manufacturer of the same medication that resulted in my daughter's death take ownership. He put blame on the foot of his industry for my daughter's death. Do you know what that was like to have to watch that? If you didn't get a chance to see it, I encourage you to watch it. The good news is that Casey's doctor now is one of the leading doctors in the ECHO program and is now prescribing Suboxone. He is dedicated to assuring that this does not happen again. Sadly, it came too late for my daughter. He cannot continue to do this without the sustainable funding from the people who haven't created real solutions, who haven't taken responsibility, and they refuse to do anything but threaten to raise drug prices. In case you haven't realized it, they don't need an excuse to raise your drug prices. They already do. I'm aware this is a David versus Goliath, and don't think I haven't realized their power. And I have had times where I'm fearful. I ask you to stand with me. I wear a shirt that says Hold Pharma Accountable. It doesn't say Hold Pharma Accountable for it all. The rest of us is paid, and it's time they do too. I need you. Frankly, I'm tired. I've been here for 3 years. I'll be here every single time I need to be, but what I really need to do is go home and grieve my daughter's death. I just need to be sad for a while. So I need you to make this right. For me, I need you to create action so I can rest and so she can too. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Bonnie Bolash?
Thank you, Chair Liebling and members of the committee. I am Bonnie Bolash, a licensed acupuncturist. I'm here today to support House File 400 because it offers comprehensive solutions to a very complex problem. How does that saying go? An ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. Today we have before us an opportunity to give patients a pain treatment that is recommended by many guidelines and many have not previously had access to. While I'm thankful for the coverage of acupuncture that is out there, there are many Minnesotans that do not have access to acupuncture because they do not have the coverage. There are people in Minnesota, such as women likely to become pregnant, people with addiction, children, the elderly, and others to whom opioids put them at greater risk of physical dependency, addiction, and death. There is a fiscal impact to families and society when this does happen. So this bill will add acupuncture to the Minnesota Essential Health Benefits. My understanding is the federal government recently changed how the benefits could be chosen and allows states more flexibility in changing their essential health benefits. I believe the state of Illinois, in response to the opioid epidemic, added 5 additional benefits. At the HHS Policy Committee meeting, the Minnesota Council of Health Plans stated that this bill would also require covering acupuncture with the state employee plan. It is my understanding that there already is some type of coverage for acupuncture. Pain patients need options. Patients that become addicted to their pain medications need help to recover. I'm here to say we need to take care of patients. You have an opportunity before you to cover the ounce of prevention to help pain patients. Please vote to support covering acupuncture. Thank you for your support of House File 400. It's a comprehensive approach that is much needed and takes the state as a leader in the nation to recognize the needs of pain patients while helping those that have been impacted by this crisis. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Dr. Heather Bell and Dr. Kurt Devine. Welcome to the committee. Please just introduce yourself for the record and go ahead.
Great. I'm Kurt Devine. I'm a family physician in Little Falls, Minnesota, and this is Dr. Heather Bell, who's also a family physician. We've been here before. Some of you, I think, know us, and we're just going to just briefly tell people some of the things that are solutions, that some of the money that we graciously got to help this state as she came through Dave Baker a couple of years ago. And programs like ours are going to continue if the funding continues through a bill like this, which are really very much prevention and then helping clean this up. We all have those sad stories. I think, you know, Dr. Reznikoff had a wonderful story, and I can tell you that there's times when things are going so well, it almost seems like nobody's dying anymore. But literally 3 weeks ago, I had a Suboxone patient who relapsed because he could not get into treatment, and he hung himself that following day, just 3 days after I saw him. And so we do get these stories, and there are things that stay with you quite a while. When we met Dave Baker, we had a program in our town that was basically looking at how we were prescribing and improving how everybody in our clinic prescribed. And we cut the, really in the last few years, the pills in our clinic by about 50%. We realized that on the other end of this problem was the treatment part. And so for us, starting to do medical-assisted treatment in a rural community seemed like the answer, but very difficult to get that experience to do that. You can get waiver to do that, but there were no mentors rurally for us. That is where our program has gotten bigger and more robust. When we met Dave Baker, he asked us if we could replicate this in other communities. And some of you live in those communities that we're at, from Hibbing all the way down to Redwood Falls. We took $1.2 million and put it into 8 communities and replicated the program that we had developed for clinics and medical-assisted treatment and task force in communities. And I can tell you that we have put 35 more Suboxone providers in these rural areas who are now taking care of over 135 patients rurally. Hennepin County, as wonderful a job as they do, they're overwhelmed with patients previously that were coming to the Twin Cities for this treatment, and we're trying to get this treatment out into the rural communities through programs like this. And so it's been a huge thing for the rural communities. I think that as time goes on, if we get more money, we believe we can put this in lots of communities with fairly small amounts of money to help them organize these programs. And so that's certainly something that we look to this bill to help continue to fund. I'll let Dr. Bell talk a little bit about our other our way of educating Minnesota, which is the ECHO program.
So,
thank you.
So, Heather Bell, and so to kind of continue on that, we got a grant through the STR grants federally that's run through DHS to do a Project ECHO. There are 3 ECHOs in Minnesota, ours, Hennepin's, and then Waysides. Our ECHO started a little over a year ago, and we're currently in 44 different counties in our state. We log on weekly and do education from appropriate prescribing to MAT to MAT in different areas of every community. That's where we help educate all of those new prescribers and where we make more contacts to get into more of these places. The fancy nice thing is that we don't have to go anywhere. We do it logged in from our clinic, and all the providers and teams around our state log in from their clinics. And the providers all get CME or CEU just to log on and learn. It's a very interactive thing. And then we do outside. That makes connections that you can then connect outside as well. So as we were doing these things, we kind of realized there was a lot of gaps in care. And one of the gaps we saw was in emergency departments. And our emergency department as well, you know, patients go to the ERs with overdoses or having received Narcan, ER docs would just say, okay, you're good, see you later. Well, that patient is going to go home and use because they're sick. Why is that? Why can't they get treatment in the ERs? And so we've done that. We've gotten our ERs to start treating patients. We actually got one of our ER docs waivered because he just jumped on board with this. And just 2 days ago, we were talking to Center Eaton in the morning, and then like an hour about ERs, and an hour later, we got a call from an ER in Aiken, who's one of our communities, saying, we have a person in our ER. We don't know what to do because our one Suboxone prescriber in Aiken is out of town. We're like, let us call the ER doc. And that ER doc treated this patient because as an ER provider, you don't necessarily need to be waivered. And this patient has come back now 3 straight days in a row and is finally feeling better from the illicit methadone she was buying off the street. And so we're really working on getting all of those communities and all the ECHO communities that we touch to get their emergency rooms on board. Another gap in care was in the jails. As y'all know, there's a lot of recidivism and in and out of jail with patients who have opioid use disorder. And so we decided to fix that too. And our jail doctor, who also works for a company that's in jails, most of the jails in our state, he got waivered. And so we are one of the first jails in the state, arguably, if not further, who actually did Suboxone induction, and we've been doing Suboxone in our county jail for almost a year and a half now. So patients come into our jails after getting arrested, start withdrawing, and they get on treatment right away, and then whether it's their out date or within a day, they're in our clinic for that continuity where they have a social worker and they have a nurse to help coordinate things that they need, whether it's treatment, housing, insurance. Finally, we did definitely go into the whole child protection thing, which I know is a huge deal with this funding. And in our critical access hospital, we deliver babies whose moms are on Suboxone. And child protection is missing. They don't need to be involved. Our patients that we've had, even the one that presented at 24 weeks still doing IV heroin and IV meth, child protection signed off because that baby was born and that baby only tested positive for Suboxone, nothing else. And so that mom got to take her baby home and keep her baby, and child protection signed off. And we, our nurse and our social worker actually sit on our child protection board in Morrison County to kind of help with those conversations. Because there's obviously a lot of people struggling who already have those kids and they're getting threatened to be taken away. We explain how our program really surrounds them, and child protection, as long as they're working well with our program, they kind of give extra concessions to these moms to really kind of embrace that. So the funding would really just kind of go to help all this continue, and we don't just do it in Morrison County, of course. We give it away. We give all of our protocols away to every single person who asks for it, and we just want to be able to continue to help with the state because there are lots of solutions out there, proven solutions, and I have handles with all of our data if anybody wants it. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for your testimony. So we have I have two more testifiers who are on the list. I think we'll just go through the testifiers if that's okay. I know we have – and then we'll take questions from the committee. So Judy Cook.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Judy Cook with Cook Girard Associates. I am representing the Association for Accessible Medicines. This is the organization representing the generic and biosimilar drug manufacturers. We have appreciated the opportunity to talk with both Representative Olson and Representative Baker about this legislation and continue to be ready to be a part of the discussions going forward. AAM recognizes that opioid and other forms of drug addiction are a significant public policy issue and a challenge for state and local government. Generic drugs are 90% of the prescription drugs sold, but only 23% of the cost. That holds true for opioids, where about 90% are manufactured by generic companies, which do not detail to physicians nor conduct direct-to-consumer advertising. Since these drugs went off patent, typically there are multiple generic manufacturers making the same product. They have no control over which of their products are sold in Minnesota. It's a national marketplace, and generics primarily are sold to the three large wholesalers. Also, the DEA determines how much any one manufacturer can make of any one given opioid, and that number has been reducing significantly each year. A priority for AAM on opioid legislation remains access to appropriate care for those individuals for whom opioids are an important course of treatment, such as cancer or end of life. There is excellent work being done to develop and utilize best practices for the prescribing of opioids for those patients for whom these drugs are appropriate and should not be disrupted. AAM supports pill limits, use of the prescription monitoring program, and other best practices to significantly limit the prescribing and use of opioids as a way to prevent addiction. There are also other effective alternatives available that should be utilized more widely. AAM is working to prevent future addiction by offering a program to educate high schoolers and college-age students about the dangers of opioid and other drug abuse. Our concern with House File 400 is that it does not recognize what has happened since opioids were first brought to market, when there were brand companies aggressively detailing to prescribers and insurers, urging physicians to treat pain with these opioids. Yet these companies bear very little of the responsibility of the fee in this bill. Instead, the licensing fee in this bill will fall primarily on generic manufacturers. Yet other entities in the supply chain have been and continue to be involved in prescribing and filling of opioid prescriptions. For generic drug manufacturers, the challenge with the structure of the stewardship fee of $12 million for the manufacturer side is that they have no control over how much of their product is sold into Minnesota. The distributors make that decision based on the amount prescribed and dispensed. Generic manufacturers have no control over which companies continue to manufacture opioids, and the number of opioids being prescribed continues to be reduced significantly, as well as the DEA allotment. As a result, each company has no way to control their proportional number of units sold in Minnesota upon which the fee is based. The fewer the number of units sold, also as well as reduced prescribing, also results in an annual increase in the per unit fee. As a result, these manufacturers have no way of knowing what the fee will be, which creates risk for the future when the fee will be assessed and paid. Again, a priority for AAM on this type of legislation remains that access to appropriate and necessary care for those individuals for whom opioids are an important course of treatment do not have their access to these medications interrupted. In any industry, when costs and fees of producing a product are larger than the revenue for that product, no business in any industry will be able to sustain operations. As we saw in the only other state to pass a significant new fee on manufacturers of opioids, because opioids are very low margin, it is a very real concern. In New York, one of the major manufacturers, which is not a member of AAM, testified that the new fee was higher than its revenue, not profit, and it would have to retreat from the market. AAM's position has remained consistent. The best way for the state to obtain the level of funding it is seeking for an opioid response, as the bill outlines, must take into account the full supply chain. Again, AAM is willing to participate in being a part of a fair solution to this crisis, one that preserves access to these necessary medications for those patients they are appropriate for. Thank you, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Cook. We'll call Todd Hill, and please stay around for questions. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Todd Hill with Hill Capital Strategies, and I'm here on behalf of my client, the Healthcare Distribution Alliance. And I also want to take a moment to recognize the work that Representative Olson and Representative Baker have done on this bill and the opportunity we've had to meet with them and talk about our concerns. The Healthcare Distribution Alliance is the national trade association representing 36 primary wholesale distributors. They are the logistics-focused link to the healthcare supply chain. They deliver medicines and healthcare supplies safely, securely, and efficiently to nearly every healthcare delivery system nationwide. The products HDA members deliver range from the most common to the most complex medications and medical supplies. HDA members as wholesalers do not research, manufacture, market, prescribe medications, nor do they influence prescriber patterns, the demand for specific products, or patient benefit design. HDA members go to great lengths to thoroughly verify and fulfill orders placed by DEA-licensed healthcare practitioners. HDA strongly supports a variety of policies that both decrease opioid demand and dispensing while encouraging the safe disposal of medications. Some of those proposals aren't contained in House File 400. However, HDA does not support the substantial volume-based industry-specific licensure fee included in this legislation. Targeting specific supply chain entities places a logistics-focused industry that completes the orders of DEA-licensed healthcare practitioners in a difficult position, one that could lead to a significant financial assessment based on a product that represents a small portion of the overall product volume. Unavailable product orders for request from healthcare practitioners or significant cost increases on distributor customers and possibly patients. This no-win situation could raise cost or decrease access for legitimate patients. HDA welcomes the opportunity to engage in a meaningful discussion involving equitable supply chain-wide solutions to achieve the goals of House File 400. We appreciate the opportunity we've had to date to work closely with legislators, stakeholders, and the governor on alternative solutions. And while believing there is still room for improvement, we have removed our opposition to this legislation in the other body and to the more equitable supply chain-wide controlled substance registration program provisions found in the governor's proposed budget. Our hope is that we can continue to work with the legislature throughout the process to improve a solution or to provide a solution that improves and works towards solving the opioid crisis in Minnesota with a fair funding for the entire supply chain. HDA does not advocate for the use of opioids. Orders from licensed medical professionals determine our distributors' shipments. We encourage the development and use of alternative pain treatments. And one day, such treatment may become common. However, there will continue to be a place for opioids in the clinical management of pain, and as a result, such products should be accessible to patients when a licensed prescriber determines that they are the appropriate and clinically necessary. It must be remembered that the scope of medical procedures that use opioids is vast, not just including those received for routine pain management from your local pharmacist. Opioid-containing products are used in epidurals during childbirth and virtually every surgical procedure. These two are impacted by this proposed legislation and assessment. HDA is committed to working with policymakers to positively influence the opioid epidemic and recognizes that the intent of House File 400 is very admirable. However, the licensure provisions in House File 400 are flawed approaches that penalize all legitimate opioid use. By punitively targeting the aspects of the supply chain that are not responsible for prescribing patterns or health care orders, this legislation puts patients and providers at risk of losing access to essential medications, ultimately doing more harm than good. HDA respectfully requests that you oppose the licensure fee that is currently in House File 400. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Hill. First of all, I would like to announce to the public that we have copies. The correct copy of House File 400 is available if you would like to pick up a correct copy. And just to remind everyone that we did adopt the A20 amendment, so that amendment still goes to the bill. So notwithstanding the fact that we had the wrong copy, we have amended House File 400. With that, I have some questions for members. We'll start with Representative Munson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Lieutenant Kazel?
Kazel.
Who testified earlier about the addiction that he's seeing on the streets and his work in combating this terrible crisis. My question is, could you speak to the percentage of cases that you found where people are overdosing on prescriptions that were prescribed to them, or is it on street drugs or stolen prescriptions?
It's a mixture of both. Yeah. Oh, you'll find...
Lieutenant Kazel, I'm sorry, we have to do this odd formality here. So, please, go ahead.
My apologies.
Go ahead, please, Lieutenant Kazel.
Okay. It's a mixture of both. It's sometimes you'll see people that are find their addiction from the pills, and when the prescriptions run out, they have to go to the next thing that's available that's actually cheaper, and they'll go to the street drugs. But there's also incidents where fake pills are out there, where they have their own pill press, and they're taking fentanyl and other chemicals and pressing pills to make it look like an Oxycontin pill. So it's a wide range of them. I don't know if that answers your question.
Representative Munson.
Yeah, thank you. My concern is that a large percentage, I mean, we've had opioids in our society for decades, but the pharmaceutical industry kind of gave a lot of other people kind of a taste of what that is, and then they find their, you know, drugs on the street, and there's been a major crisis, especially over our southern border, with fentanyl and other drugs coming in. It's feeding this crisis, and you spoke briefly to the federal grants that were available, right. And then my understanding is that it's becoming a big issue federally. They're creating funding for more programs that will be available too. Are there other programs that you're aware of that you can apply for federal grants?
Yes, we're actively seeking money to go after this program. We need resources is what it comes down to, and I feel like I'm on the road all the time looking for more funding sources for us to get the job done, because we don't have enough.
Okay. All right. And one more, Representative Munson. We have other people on the list.
So this bill as written is good for about 3 years, and then they have to go back and assess whether they would continue with the program. If this bill passes and there's $20 million that's taxed on the pharmaceutical companies and wholesalers, and provides money or a funding stream for you to combat this addiction crisis in your area, would you be hiring additional employees or making commitments to spending money to continue this combating? And if it was to come to an abrupt halt, would that disrupt your process for combating opioids?
I think we would be – I'm sorry. I'll get it. I promise. I would see us looking for programs that, I mean, we're thinking out of the box right now, okay? The program that we started with this federal grant that we received last year, it's out of the box thinking. We've never done anything like this before. And that's what we need to do. It's a three-pronged approach that we're going at. We're going to continue to do aggressive law enforcement and going after sources of supply. We're going to do a lot better job of educating our public and preventing people from getting into that pool of addiction. But with this new program, we're pulling people out. And that pool of addiction is what drives the demand that has people come to our areas and to take advantage of people that have an addiction, have a disease.
All right, thank you.
All right, thank you, Lieutenant Kazel. And I have a couple more questions, members on the list for questions, and I just want to let everybody know that we do have another bill today. We do have room 200 reserved for this evening if we do need to come back, so just to let members know that. But it was kind of my intention to finish up with this bill fairly soon so that we can maybe complete our business within our regular time. So, but with that, I'll call on Representative Halverson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for indulging me to ask a couple questions. My questions are going to be to Dr. Reznikoff, so if he can come down. But I wanted to start just with an opening that I am sickened that we are sitting in a committee hearing again, having to hear from parents who lost children. It breaks my heart. It breaks all of our hearts. And these folks have to fight every day. And they're fighting for our kids. They're fighting to make sure that our kids don't have to go through what their kids went through. And we sit here and say, boy, it's complicated. Boy, we have to think about it. And it seems real simple to me. I think that the Tylenol example is a great example of a company taking responsibility to make sure that their products are safe, to make sure that the public is safe. And guess whose fault the Tylenol killings were? It wasn't Tylenol's fault. It was the fault of the murderer who decided to taint Tylenol. 7 people died, and every single package of Tylenol was pulled off the shelves. Was that a hit to Tylenol's bottom line? You bet. They were the best-selling pain reliever in the country. Did they say, boy, I'm concerned that people aren't going to be able to get their Tylenol? They didn't. Did they say, I'm concerned about our bottom line? They didn't. Did they say they don't want to see more people dying? They did. That is corporate responsibility. Sitting at a table and saying, it wasn't our fault, when you have made billions of dollars off of the sale of opioids, is, at best, ineffective. You're wrong. You're wrong. There are billions of dollars flowing through the system into people's pockets for profit. And we have line items from all of our counties saying this is what the opioid epidemic costs us. We have law enforcement saying this is what the opioid epidemic costs us. You know what? If you wanted to help and be part of the solution, help our local governments with their budgets that are having to deal with the issues that these issues are causing. That they're having to put dollars away from things like prevention of other drug enforcement, that they're having to take dollars away from public safety, that they're having to take dollars away from services for people with disabilities. Local governments are the ones who take care of people, and their budgets are being blown up by this, and families are being decimated. Pardon me, Madam Chair, for my frustration. I don't want these parents to have to come and implore us again to take action. So a couple of brief questions I had, thank you, Dr. Reznikoff, is can you talk a little bit about how prescribing among physicians is changing with regard to opioids? It didn't used to be a common thing that people would get a prescription for fentanyl and people would get a prescription. I actually had an emergency room situation where I tore my gastroc muscle and I WebMD'd it, and they insultingly said it was an injury of middle-aged athletes. And I went to the hospital, and they were very insistent that I needed opioids for this. And I said, I don't. I'm sitting here right now with no pain relief at all, and I'm fine. And so that was several years ago. So I'm wondering if you can describe a little how that might be changing in the prescribing community, because that's a problem.
Dr. Reznikoff.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Weekend warriors is what we call that type of athlete. Let me first say in response to your remarks that as a general rule, I believe that all of us in the healthcare industry are all in the patient care industry. And I don't believe anyone should be able to say we're logistics only. We are not involved in patient care. Even if you're not in the room, you're in the healthcare industry, which means you have should be held to some standard of patient care professionalism, and that gets to your point, and that gets to the example of Tylenol being pulled from the market. That's a patient care decision. To answer your question, we're in a sort of a messy transition that is happening over the last prior couple years and will continue over the next couple years, where we are rolling out, educating physicians, nurse practitioners, physician's assistants, and rolling out standards and guidelines. And in other parts of the state government, there's an organization that is developing measures of opioid prescribing and offering each prescriber individualized feedback to what they do on a yearly basis to help improve them, allow them to understand their prescribing and improve that prescribing. So it's it doesn't happen at the snap of a finger, but there are many guidelines. There's a lot of education happening, and people are sort of, in a messy way, learning. March, this month, tomorrow, March, the first report to every prescriber in the state is going to be issued from the state of Minnesota, allowing them to see their own prescribing habits compared to their peers and compared to the guidelines. And there's no penalty. It's information only this year. And then going forward, there's going to be some teeth to those reports. So there's a process in the state that is affecting every doc and nurse practitioner and physician's assistant. So I don't know if that answers your question. Thank you, Minette.
That does. That was very helpful.
And briefly, one more, and I appreciate the latitude, Madam Chair, but could you comment, and maybe you can, if you can't, that's okay, but I've seen other types of drug and alcohol addiction treatment where patients are there in inpatient treatment for weeks or months. And I understand that opioid addiction treatment is very different. It's years to really treat this addiction. Is that the case,
yeah. Dr. Reznikoff?
Thank you, Madam Chair. In one sense, all addictions are considered chronic diseases, and no addiction is considered to be curable, and whether that's tobacco or alcohol or anything. However, the difference, and that is true of opioids, as it is true of all addictions, there you can recover, but there's no cure. But opioids are different in how quickly they are lethal. One little mistake and you're dead. The first mistake, you're often dead. So the difference with opioids is not that it's more chronic, it's that it's more lethal and there's less room for error. You're really walking a tightrope. And that's why ongoing surveillance, monitoring, support is doubly critical with opioids, because the first slip-up is often a fatal one.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair.
All right. Thank you, Representative Halverson. Thank you, Dr. Reznikoff. Representative Grunhagen.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I just want to thank the testifiers and for Representative Baker and Olson for bringing this issue forward. It certainly needs to be vetted. I just want to state also, just right up front, I have supported all the restrictions that have gone forth as far as opiates are concerned. I've been affected in my own family, immediate family, with my father-in-law who almost died of prescription drugs and opioids. I have clients who have addictions and have passed away from some of them, so I understand the pain, the anguish, and the heartache that comes with addictions. I don't think any of us are insulated from that in today's society. I do think that I do have a couple of concerns about the bill. Number one, there was Judy Cook testified that we're going to be hitting the generic companies who were not the major culprits with most of these fees. And to me, I want to go after the major culprits. There are national lawsuits that are being filed, similar to tobacco lawsuits, which I do believe eventually will be decided in favor of states, and depending on the severity of the opioid crisis, you'll probably get it proportioned to a certain amount of the settlements, similar to tobacco. I know that drags out versus this, okay? I do have a little bit of a concern also in the bill that it seems like the wording is such that the fee could continue through perpetuity without definitive action by the legislature. And what I mean by that is, unless we take action, I'd prefer a sunset clause, especially if the lawsuit funds would come to us out of these areas. But the last thing I'll just bring out, because I know we're short on time, is there is a federal court decision in December of 2018. You're probably familiar with it. But basically, a federal judge struck down the New York assessment on pharmaceutical companies. And again, it was a lot more money. It was $600 million. But I'll just read a couple comments from the judge's decision, which I have a summary of here. He said that the assessment on these drug companies is punitive. It's on a targeted group, and therefore it could endanger medication access for patients. His next summary was, such an assessment threatens the affordability of medications, as any prohibition of passing costs to customers is unconstitutional. I don't believe that's in this bill. His third comment was, such an assessment stigmatizes prescription opioid customers in New York differently than customers purchasing the same pharmaceutical drug out of state. And finally, his conclusion is, as a federal judge, when he struck down this assessment, he said the federal court decision made it clear that placing a financial assessment on legally ordered and prescribed opioid medications is an ill-conceived approach to addressing the opioid epidemic. Today's epidemic is a multifaceted, complex issue that is largely being fueled by illegal activity targeting legitimate supply chain entities that complete orders placed by registered healthcare professionals and pharmacies, threatens to increase medical costs, and in turn jeopardize accessibility for legitimate patients. Are you aware of this decision, and have you taken that into consideration in terms of the drafting your bill is the question?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Grunhagen. Yes, we are aware of that, and the specific piece you're referencing is not, we don't have the Commerce Clause in this legislation. So we can speculate on the future and happy to do that, but we are very aware of that, and that Commerce Clause is not in our, in not in this bill.
Okay, Representative Zerwas.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members, and just want to touch on, someone was talking about the child protection cases that are that were open in 2017, and I think one of the members referenced it, saying that these numbers represent child protection cases in which opioids were the main culprit. And I just was communicating back and forth with the director in Sherburne County for Human Services, and said in 2017, on the information I have here, 66 open child protection cases. How many of those were due to opiates and or the opioid crisis? And the response I got back from her was probably a handful. The ones that were drug-related were mainly methamphetamine. And so I just wanted to make sure that this information is, that members know what it's truly depicting. This is not opioid-specific information. I want to make sure that was on the record.
Madam Chair, can I respond to that?
Well, I don't know if Representative Zerwas, he has the floor. Why don't we let Representative Zerwas finish and then you can respond.
Madam Chair, I was just clarifying. Yeah. I think a member had mentioned that in their comments, and I just wanted to make sure that that people were clear of what the information is depicting. Representative Olson, we talked in the last committee, and I think I talked about my concerns about how the finances are raised, and we didn't really dig into it in government operations because it wasn't the Finance Committee. We're here. We're finally here, and so we can talk about it. My concern is with the way the bill is set up and the funding mechanism is we're setting a goal mark or an end point of the $20 million to be raised annually, and we're doing the math backwards to get there. And so everything goes great if doctors prescribe more carefully, if treatment, early intervention occurs, and addiction and abuse goes down, if the number of units of pills, of patches, of milliliters prescribed and distributed in Minnesota, if everything you want to happen, according to this legislation, happens, the end result is that for each manufacturer and distributor operating in Minnesota, their bill goes up. Because as the volume goes down, what we say needs to be raised stays the same. And so your per pill price just goes up and up and up and up. And so my question then is, doesn't this disincentivize companies to lower the amount of opioids being distributed in the state?
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just going back to the first point, I think you referenced in my opening, I talked about St. Louis County spending $26 million on out-of-home child placement costs. I did check in with my county, and they were able to tell, outside of alcohol, specific to drug use cases over the last handful of years, they were able to target, and I'm sure someone else could speak. I'm not an expert on this, but there's also poly use that a lot of times if someone is meth and opioids and others too, so addiction. So if you're talking about it, I can cite for you and get the information. And I would recommend every member reach out to their counties and ask specifically about the impacts of opioids regarding these numbers, because it is really striking. So I did want to say that if you were referencing mine, I'd be happy to cite that, because I did get that from my county. But in regards to your second point, I think one of the things, and Representative Baker will probably want to respond to this as well, is if you look at the future is where we're going, right? And you heard Lieutenant Jeff Kazel say that January of this year was one of the most deadly years Duluth has ever had and St. Louis County has had. Prescriptions are going down, but the impact of what this crisis has is only getting worse, right? So we're talking about $20 million. And I said again, $26 million my county has spent, and it's only getting worse. So if we're asking to be held accountable for $20 million, I mean, that's a drop in the bucket, and continues to go. And I would be happy to call up, Dr. Weiberg to talk about what the actual cost is we're talking per unit on when we're talking about opioids in the per unit, because I think that also puts it into perspective of the amount we're actually talking about. And maybe that would be helpful just to understand what we're actually asking, what that cost will actually be. So therefore, when we equate it to, what's going to happen with prices of drug costs or things you're talking about, it might be helpful just to have context of what we're actually talking about with that.
All right. Well, thank you, Representative Olson. Why don't we hold off on that for now? I'm kind of looking at the clock. We only, this committee only is supposed to go for until quarter after the hour, and then we're kind of debating whether we should extend the time. We do have the room. We could continue on, at least until 2:30, if not 2:40. I don't know if members are open to that or not. We can always come back this evening after session if we don't do that to complete our work. I'm hoping we're going to get through this bill, however. Anyway, why don't we continue on? Representative Hamilton said he has a brief question. Maybe we can wrap this up. I'm sorry, Representative Zerwas.
I have a few more questions if we're able to.
You do. Okay. Well, then members, we will go till 2:40, and then if we still don't complete this bill, we will come back after session. Go ahead, Representative Zerwas.
All right. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think as we look at how this is laid out, and we look at the legislation in the other bodies. I mean, I understand that the opioid crisis in areas is ravaging communities. I mean, I understand that, Representative Olson, and I understand where you're coming from. That I think one of the challenges is the mechanism you have to raise the money in your bill take someone like a distributor who has no control over where their medication is goes. They order, they fill it, and so sometimes it comes to Minnesota. The way the mechanism, the funding mechanism works, it works as a proportion of what they are in the total distributed in the state. But the assessment period is behind them. And so they operate because of trade secrets, because of how the system works. They have no idea if they're a tenth of the market, if they're a third of the market, if they're a half of the market. And so they operate their business. Several months later, the Board of Pharmacy issues them an invoice. And their invoice says, you are a third of the market. And so here's $2.5 million. So they do the same business next year, the same exact business. But if things go well and the bill is working and other efforts are working, maybe they're half the market the following year. And they say, congratulations. The last 12 months, you didn't know this. You had no control over it. You had no ability to change it or impact it. But you were half the market. Here's your bill for $4 million. And so they did the same business, the same amount of units, and now it's $1 million, $1.5 million more for them. It has nothing to do with how their operation changed or didn't change. It's all external factors by how this is raised out of proportionality. Because in the bill, we say no matter what, we're going to raise $20 million. And so if the numbers drop, we'll just make it more expensive per unit. And so as distributors or manufacturers pull out of the state or stop operating in the state or significantly decrease in the state, those that are continuing to provide medication for terminal cancer patients, chronic pain patients, and other patients that are getting legitimate prescriptions from legitimate doctors are getting these bills. They're getting them months after the fact with no insight or ability to predict what they will be. It's a very challenging environment. And then let's just say there's a concern and they don't think they've been assessed from the Board of Pharmacy the right amount. Well, don't worry. This bill has an appeals process. You can appeal it to the Board of Pharmacy, the exact group that levied the fee. And so there's a lot of mechanisms about how this is funded that is very concerning and very troubling. The good work you're trying to accomplish, where the money is set to be spent, all of that I fully 100% support. The challenge is the backwards way in which the money is raised, where you set the amount and then work the math backwards. It's untenable, it's unplannable, and it's unfair.
I don't know if you want to respond, Representative Olson. I think we could go to Representative Hamilton, if that's okay. And you will have opportunity again. Representative Hamilton.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is extremely frustrating. My interpretation is this. If we do not allow the drug companies the opportunity to continue to do us harm, then their response is going to be they're going to do us even more harm. I'm sick of it. I'm absolutely sick of it. I want to thank Representative Olson and Representative Baker for bringing this forward, and I want you both to know that I'm on your team. My question is this. We heard from testifiers that said that they wish to be part of a meaningful discussion. My question is this. Have you reached out to individuals, even the people who oppose the bill and are, have been against it or on the other side? Have you reached out to them? Have they been part of the discussion, and has it been meaningful up to this point?
Representative Olson?
Madam Chair, thank you. And thank you, Representative Hamilton, for that. You know, we've had discussions, and the governor has called folks to the table as well. And I did get a chance, and I have had them in my office, and, you know, we have points of disagreement. And when asked for a meaningful solution, I was presented with an equitable supply chain option. And just actually last night, I got curious and got out my calculator, and I did some math on what they had given me as a proposed option. And I looked at the average revenue of a manufacturer with what they said that they would pay here, and it would be 0.0000024% of the revenue. That's seven zeros after the decimal point. And when asked, when I ran the average, what the proposed registration costs would be for a physician and surgeon, and I found the average cost for a person in the state of Minnesota, that would be, meaning with we did those percents, they'd be paying 5 cents. And so these, looking at these things, it's completely not equitable. And if we went based on the percentage here, we would be saying a physician or surgeon should be making $8.3 million in the state of Minnesota if we were going to make it fair based on their price scale here. So I did ask for that, and I wasn't actually going to bring this up today, but I'm actually glad you brought it up, because it does get me a little upset when we do ask for an equitable, and the word equitable is in the bullet point that they gave me proposing that solution. So if we leave people to their own devices and we don't ask for legislation and we don't say you're accountable for $20 million, I don't think that we're going to get there if we don't do something to really bring people to the table with legislation.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hamilton. So, Representative Munson, there is an amendment in the packet. Do you want to move the amendment?
Yes, Madam Chair. I would like to move Amendment A-19.
So the Representative Munson moves the A-19-0051 amendment. Members should have that. Representative Munson, to your amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I know that I think 8 or 9 of the members of this committee are co-authors of this bill. So I was opposed to a bill similar to this last year because I'm here at the legislature to lower health care costs. That's my number one focus. And what I saw last year with the penny a pill tax, which was worked out to be more than a penny a pill, in this bill too, which taxes the supply chain of pharmaceuticals in some manner, will directly raise the cost of drugs. And I witnessed my father dying of pancreatic cancer last year and the amount of opiates that he used to help him in the end of his life. I don't want to see the people who are in most need of opiates have to foot the bill to pay for an addiction crisis that extends beyond opiates that are out there, just prescription drugs. We have a major crisis, and I believe we're in a crisis. I don't know. I mean, we're maybe in the middle or towards the end of it because we've identified it, and the market itself has made major changes in cutting the number of prescription drugs by half, is from what I understand from a lot of numbers. And we need to really combat the illegal and illicit drug trade and also with addiction with that. In my counties, it's mostly meth that's the problem now and not opiates. The amendment that I'm offering is to sunset this provision and not just have a discussion in 3 years, which is a way to kick the can down the road and continue increasing the cost of these drugs. And as Representative Zerwas brought, if we are successful in continuing to lower the amount of prescription drugs that are prescribed, the cost, the burden, will be shifted onto the sickest and the people who are in most of need of these opiates in our society. And that's what's really saddening to me. So I want to actually end this bill after 3 years unless we can look at the data and make an informed decision that taxing the pharmaceutical industry or the prescription drugs, raising the cost of drugs on the sickest, is the best way to raise revenue for these programs. And I'm a data guy, and I love looking at numbers. And I can already imagine the spreadsheet that's coming out that's going to show the last 30 years before this bill was enacted on how the opiates are prescribed, and then since it was enacted, and it'll show it's lower because we're already making major shifts in how we prescribe drugs, and the number of drugs are going down. And I think that this program is going to appear that it's very effective in lowering drugs, when in actuality, the real market and the doctors now understand they're doing wrong and they're changing their practices, and we're having great and successful programs out there combating addiction. I'm fearful that this program is going to appear successful when it really isn't. There's great things that they're going to do with the money. I think if we had it coming out of the general fund as opposed to taxing the poor and the sick. That's my biggest concern. So this will actually sunset the provision. We'll have another discussion in 3 years if this is effective, have a detailed discussion, but that's my amendment. And members, I ask for a yes vote.
Representative Baker.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and I would urge members to wholeheartedly reject this amendment. I think it's an embarrassment to what we've been working on. For the past 25 years, the drug manufacturing companies have enjoyed great profits because of a bad product, extended release of oxycodone that was extended release. For us to just shut this down after 3 years, we're just getting the thing off the ground. To get this good work, everybody seems to like what we're doing with the money if we get it in, and then we can do some good things with it. But as you've noticed, the budget releases, we're going down and down and down with any extra money we have. And if we were in a billion-dollar shortfall instead of a billion-dollar surplus, would we be thinking about this any different? I think we're good stewards of the money. We should stay firm on this. I'm not opposed to a reasonable sunset. I've been talking to the chair, the lead author about this since the beginning, and we're still working through that. That's what we do. But 3 years is not the right one. I would absolutely reject this wholeheartedly, members. And I hope if members don't know and understand this well enough to help me understand so that I can give them more background, please come to me. I've had many conversations with many members. I stand ready at all times. So with that, I'll just urge a no vote.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Representative Munson.
I apologize. There was a couple of small changes to the amendment that I'd walked through with our analyst. To correct the line numbers, I think it was made an amendment off of a previous version of the bill. And I also asked for a roll call vote, Madam Chair.
Okay, good. Well, all right. So what are the changes?
The changes are on 1.3 of the amendment where it says page 7. It's actually line 4. I'm sorry, line 11. And then on page 8, line 1.4 of the amendment, it should read page 8 after line 34. And then on line 1.6 of the amendment, it should read page 9 after line 19.
Okay, so Representative Munson incorporates those changes into his amendment. The clerk will call the roll.
Liebling.
No.
Akam.
No.
Baker.
No.
Bierman.
No.
Cantrell.
No.
Branson. Grunhagen.
Yes.
Haley.
No.
Halverson.
No.
Hamilton.
No.
Kunesh-Podein.
No.
Loeffler.
No.
Mann. No. Moran. Munson.
Yes.
Noor. Olson.
No.
Schumacher. Schultz.
No.
Zerwas.
Pass.
There being 13 ayes, 13 nays, sorry, and zero, sorry, let me say that again. There being 2 ayes and 13 nays and 1 pass, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. I would be remiss if I did not ask if there was anyone else in the room who wanted to testify for or in opposition to the bill. Seeing none, we will then move to the vote on the bill. Oh, I know Representative Mann wanted recognition. Representative Mann.
Thank you, Madam Chair. One quick point, if you want to decrease the cost of health care, let's get people off of opioids. Right. And the other thing is I've been in the legislature now for 2 whole months, I think. And in the last 2 months, I'm already so tired of people telling heartbreaking stories about suffering and struggle and death. And our response is 2. One is, well, that's not the real problem. It's something else. It's not opioids. It's something else. Or 2 is, yeah, but what about the multi-billion-dollar companies? How are they going to feel? People are dying. And we're concerned about the bottom line of a company or companies that take home over $500 billion per year. Just throwing that out there. This bill is for the people of this state and not for the corporation. So I would like a roll call, Madam Chair.
All right. Roll call being requested. The clerk will take the roll on House File 400 as amended.
Liebling.
Aye.
Akam.
Aye.
Baker.
Aye.
Bierman.
Aye.
Cantrell.
Aye.
Franson. Grunhagen.
No.
Haley.
Pass.
Helverson.
Aye.
Hamilton.
Yes.
Kunesh-Podein. Loeffler.
Aye.
Mann.
Yes.
Moran. Munson.
No.
Noor. Olson.
Yes.
Schumacher. Schultz.
Yes.
Zerwas.
All right, there being 11 ayes and 3 nays, House File 400 as amended is recommended to go to Ways and Means. Members, we will continue the hearing now. If we can just quickly do the next bill, maybe we can not have to come back this evening. So Representative Mann is going to take the gavel. And while we're getting ready, if we could just ask members of the audience to please take your conversations outside. I know there's a lot to talk about, but we are going to continue the hearing here, and we'd like to move things as quickly as possible.
Okay, so we have Bill House File 1297 in front of us. Madam Chair, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would like to move House File 1297 to be laid over for possible inclusion in the division bill.
Okay.
Members, this is a bill that was went through last year. I believe it was in the omnibus bill that was vetoed. This is we had an overview in this committee on this topic about what we call the outpatient drug rule. This has to do with the way the state, the way Medicaid pays for drugs that are used in outpatient settings. And the we are under some changes from the federal government requiring us to change the way we pay for these drugs. If we don't do that, we are at risk of losing around $190 million in federal funding. So that's the genesis of the bill. I'm going to turn it over to Mr. Burdick from DHS, and he's going to explain it a little bit more.
Mr. Burdick.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Matt Burdick with DHS. As Representative Liebling described, this bill would bring Minnesota into compliance with what's known as the federal outpatient drug rule. This applies to how drugs are reimbursed in the fee-for-service medical assistance program, Minnesota's Medicaid program. As we heard in the overview several weeks ago, there's really two pieces to how pharmaceutical reimbursement works. As our pharmacy director, Chad Hope, often talks about, it's similar to auto repair. There are parts and there are labor. So essentially you're paying for the cost of the drug and the act of dispensing the drug. The new federal rule requires that we pay the actual cost for both the drug and the cost of dispensing. And so what we are changing in this bill is changing our pharmacy reimbursement schedule to reflect that. So we are using a national benchmark to identify the cost of the drugs, and then we are using a fee from a similarly situated state, Indiana, to establish the dispensing fee. This bill would also add an ongoing cost of dispensing survey so that the legislature could have insight into what the cost of dispensing is ongoing and could update that as needed based on the information that survey includes. This bill also includes several items that were the result of work with stakeholders that are not directly related to the federal compliance. One piece is an add-on for the value of the provider tax that is passed through from drug wholesalers onto pharmacies, and that is added onto the reimbursement rate for pharmacies. The other is some additional payments to hospitals that are very negatively impacted by this federal rule and how we pay for drugs that are reimbursed through what is known as the 340B program, and that's resulting in a reduction in revenue to particularly hospitals that do a lot of high-cost, very expensive drugs, such as drugs dealing with HIV. And then the last piece is removing a prohibition on managing hemophilia clotting factor on our preferred drug list. This allows the state to begin conversations with drug manufacturers about obtaining supplemental drug rebate, and that's helping to offset the cost of bringing the state into compliance.
Thank you, Mr. Burdick. Please stick around for questions a little bit. And Chair Liebling, did you want to have other testifiers?
Well, I didn't bring my agenda up to the table here, but I think there were some other testifiers. Hi.
Oh, please say your name for the committee.
My name is Matt Anderson. I represent the Minnesota Hospital Association. The agenda has me listed as Todd Anderson. I apologize to him. So I know the time is precious, and I don't want to belabor things. The Minnesota Hospital Association strongly supports this bill, both to get our drug payment system into compliance with federal law. We are one of only four states that are not in compliance now, and we've made several attempts with the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to try to sort of shoehorn our way in, and those haven't worked, and we want to make sure that we don't lose that federal matching fund. The other point that I'd like to make is, as Mr. Burdick said, there are a select few hospitals that, because they serve large numbers of Medicaid patients and they provide very sophisticated, expensive pharmaceutical treatments, HIV, hemophilia, cystic fibrosis, blood diseases, that the increase in the dispensing fee doesn't come nearly close to the decrease in the acquisition cost of the drug because the drugs are so expensive. And so we have worked with the Department of Human Services. They've been very cooperative in trying to figure out a modest partial solution. So what we have in the bill is not going to make these hospitals whole, but it will buffer or mitigate some of the losses that they will experience because of the services they provide and the patients they treat. With that, I'll stand for questions if you have any.
Thank you, Mr. Anderson. Are there any testifiers in the audience today? Okay. Please state your name for the committee.
Madam Chair, Representative Liebling. Buck Humphrey, Minnesota Pharmacy Alliance, and we won't go over what Mr. Burdick said. We are in support of this legislation. It is consequential to pharmacy. It obviously recalibrates the reimbursement that we receive from medical assistance and really is the floor for our reimbursement, so we really appreciate all your work on this and would stand for any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Humphrey. Are there any questions from the committee? Seeing none, would House File 1297 is laid over for possible inclusion in the HS Finance Division bill?
Thank you. Thank you, members.
And the meeting's adjourned.